Good afternoon, everybody. We'll call the meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is now 1:06 PM, Friday, February 11, 2022. Here with us today producing a quorum are Representative Shragi, Representative Gillum, Representative Hannon, Representative Rauscher, myself, Representative Putkadup, and Representative Kronk. Online, we can see Representative McKay's big, beautiful face, and hopefully we will have Representative Hopkins and Representative Fields joining us in a timely manner. On today's agenda, we're going to pick up where we left off on House Bill 287 and also House Bill 52. We'll have public testimony later on House Bill 52, and I'd like to note that if anybody's in the room looking to testify, to please be sure to sign in before 3 o'clock. Going right into it, with House Bill 287, on Wednesday we had some initial questions, and there should have been follow-up done online and via email and through BASIS. But I wanted to give the opportunity for members to ask questions of the sponsor or any experts online that weren't able to be answered via the follow-up. So Representative Rauscher will take the hot seat. We also have Colleen Glover online with the Tax Division and Connor Bell, Legislative Finance, to answer any questions. So with that, are there any questions from committee members? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize. I guess I did not see an answer, but it's been a busy couple of days, to my initial question about the lapsing fund structure and the choice of that language. And I know we had some conversations, but I just wanted to see if we had Department of Law's answer on that as opposed to Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. And unfortunately, it looks like Mr. Bell and Glover are not online yet to be able to help answer those questions. We do not have Department of Law online. I know there was a memo that should have been posted to BASIS in regards to the sweepability.
And that's what I have not seen
that. Through the chair, I wish we could have had them, but right now they are busy because of the deadline that's coming up on the 18th. So it's getting crowded for them to break away, and I just thought I'd let you know why they weren't able to come today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher, and just like Batman, Representative or Mr. Bell is now online to help with that answer. So, Mr. Bell, if you can please do a mic check and work to address Representative Hannon's question.
For the record, this is Connor Bell, Fiscal Analyst of Legislative Finance Division. So, the oil and gas tax credit fund, it's not that it's subjected to sweep because the sweep provision applies to money in the general fund available for appropriation. And since the amount into the oil and gas tax credit fund has already been appropriated, when that money goes from the oil and gas tax credit fund out to producers or companies or whoever basically we're paying for those tax credits, the legislature doesn't have to approve an appropriation for that, those payments that go out. And so since it doesn't require a further appropriation, it's not subject to the sweep.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bell and Representative Hannon. And we also have now been joined by Ms. Glover from the Tax Division. Ms. Glover, if you'd like to address anything.
Committee, sorry for I was on muted online. This is Colleen Glover, Tax Division Director. For the record, I don't have anything more to add from what Mr. Bell talked about the sweeping. The hearing earlier this week, we talked about the funds aren't subject to lapse. So I think that issue's been addressed, and I believe Connor's response answers the question about whether it's sweepable or not.
Thank you, Ms. Glover. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chairman. Your staff provided me a copy of the memo. I should have done my homework and read. So I apologize for that. So now my question goes to the Mr. Bell's memo of February 10th answering Representative Shragi's question about the two bills. So before us is 287, but there's also House Bill 250 that also has another $60 million for oil tax credit. And if both bills were enacted, a total of $120 million would be appropriated into the oil and gas tax credit fund. Now, my understanding, that would then exceed the minimum tax that was due this year. So either for Ms. Glover or Mr. Bell, would that mean that $60 million of it would remain for that fund to start out for FY23, or would we exceed the minimum tax that was owed for FY22 if both bills and both appropriations totaling $120 million passed?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rocha.
Thank you. I appreciate the question, and it did come up. But I could tell you, when these bills reach finance, they're going to sort them out. They're not going to let both of them go through adding these funds together like that. So on whichever bill may or may not, or both may not reach there, either way, both of them are going to be going in that direction. And when both of them get there, depending on what the previous one had done before the first one, before the second one arrived, is how they're going to treat the bills as they come in, if you understand what I'm saying. So they won't let that happen.
Thank you, Representative Rocher. And Representative Hanna, any follow-up? I mean, it's to my understanding that the other bill that you referenced hasn't left committee yet in the Finance Committee, and that's, I think, the next bill, committee of assignment for this bill. So does that suffice to your... I mean, I guess it poses the argument why we didn't get the other bill in this committee either, right? So any other questions from committee members in regards to 287? Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Puckettuck. Representative Rouster, can you just talk to me a little bit about why we've decided to use UGF this time to fund this fund as opposed to using CBR dollars as was previously proposed?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Shragi, we all were there last year, and we saw the many amendments, and they came through on the, not only on the floor but in finance. And so there was a big discussion on how it should be handled. And I think it got tripped up in CBR because of probably the way the House views, the different caucuses in the House view the usage of the CBR. And it's going to need a two-thirds vote, two or three-quarters, I forget which at this point. But either way, it's going to need more than just a majority. And that's one of the reasons that it failed. And so I wanted to make sure that we didn't have to go through that again. And so that's why I chose the way we did.
Follow up,
Representative Shrug.
I mean, I think there seems to be some broad support for paying our debts. It's certainly mm-hmm. something that I believe strongly in. I guess I'm curious, would it show a stronger, would it provide a stronger statement of support to the industry that we are, as a legislature, intending to pay our debts if the monies were to come from that CBR with a higher vote threshold? And also, can you speak to the ability for the CBR, for us to pull funds from the CBR? Are there enough monies there? Can you answer those two questions?
Representative Rocher.
I guess I need to repeat what you're really asking me.
Do you think it would show, through the chair, do you think it would show a stronger statement of support if we were to use CBR dollars with that higher vote threshold to fund these oil and gas tax credits? I guess I'm somewhat perplexed or caught in this catch-22, and I don't know if it's quite the correct characterization, where, you know, why don't we just, if it's a lot easier to use UGF dollars in the next year, why not just fail the CBR vote year after year and wait until the next session and use UGF dollars? Would it be better to use CBR here?
Well, I through the chair, Representative Shragi, I think I already gave you my opinion on why I chose this route, and I believe it's still the best route. What the statement makes to the oil companies, I think passing it in both houses, whether it is in the Senate and the House of Representatives here, I think is the important thing that the oil companies would like to see happen. And I think that would say more to them than not getting it at all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shragi. Any other questions in regards to House Bill 287 from the committee? Okay, seeing or hearing none, for the record, Representative Hopkins has joined us at 112. Welcome. The plan is to have amendments due to the office by 1 p.m. on Sunday, the 13th, and depending on the flavor of the committee, take up action on House Bill 287 on Monday, the 14th. So we'll now set House Bill 287 aside. Thank you, Representative Rauscher.
Thank you very much, Chairman and the committee.
Hopefully we can avoid a Valentine's Day massacre. Moving to the next item on today's agenda, we've got House Bill 52. We last heard House Bill 52 on Monday and had a great discussion on it. Members should have received emailed answers to committee questions, and they should have been posted to BASIS also. And today the plan is to take up public testimony on House Bill 52. Before we go into public testimony, would members like to ask questions that may have come up between now in the last meeting that may have not been answered offline? If so, we have the bill sponsor here along with Department of Fish and Game online to help facilitate answers to those questions. Committee members? Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And I think my question is actually a DNR question. Do we have a DNR person?
Yep. Ms. Alvarez, if you can please be ready for Representative Hannon's question.
Thank you. Through the chair. So I am interested in knowing and understanding if we have ever removed legislatively designated lands from an existing state park previous to this, or is this the first time we've ever done it? In addition, I'm also interested if any of the management plans that have existed since the park was created in 1970, and then the hatchery was built in 1976, if there has ever been a conflict in that management plan for the use of the land.
Ms. Alvarez, can you do a mic check and put your name on the record and proceed to address Representative Hannon's question?
Yes. Can everyone hear me?
We can hear you fine. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hannon through the chair. There has been a previous instance where lands have been accepted from a legislatively designated area to, again, address the disposal issue. That would have been legislation, I don't know the year, but it accepted land out of Denali State Park in anticipation of the gas line easement.
Representative Hannon, follow up.
Thank you. And do you know in that example, since the easement for, is that still pending, the use of an easement for a gas line, or was there any revision, revert language in that use if the gas line is never built? Does it revert into the Denali State Park, or does it remain DNR general land for use?
I would have to look into the details, but as I understand it, that particular legislation did not include a reverter clause, and it accepted the lands from the park for the pipeline easement.
Follow-up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And through the chair, and do you know, have any of the state park management plans for Kachemak Bay ever articulated a conflict or objection to the hatchery?
The draft plans that we have been working on over the last 9 years have, in fact, listed the hatchery as incompatible most recently in the intent to adopt version of that plan, not because of a compatibility per se, well, for two reasons, namely because we recognize that there's an issue related to a disposal of interest, and additionally, because of the definition of a scenic park and the enabling legislation requiring these lands to be managed according to that definition.
Follow-up, Representative Hannon.
So, through the chair, the park was created, though, in 1970, and so prior to the last 9 years, my assumption has been there's been a number of state park management plans that would have never indicated a conflict or even though the park was a designated scenic part. Is that correct?
That's correct. I will say the previous 1995 plan wasn't as specific as the plan that we have for us or intending to adopt before us now in terms of the permitting matrices that we provide, and notably in 1995, the case law that we have before us now was just not in our mindset. And so the case that I think is most relevant here was in 2013, and certainly we developed the most recent plan with that in mind.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Alvarez. Any other committee member questions before we move into public testimony?
I've got a question.
Representative Fields, thanks for joining us at 117 for the record.
Yeah, sorry to be late. Just wanted to get an understanding of the number of fishermen, I guess, both Driftnet and Saners who pay into this hatchery and other hatcheries, and the number of fishermen who catch the pinks produced by the hatchery. I don't know if that'd be Mr. Ray Bung or who the right person to provide those numbers would be. Thank you.
Well, we got quite the panel online, so between Mr. Ray Bung and anyone else, if you can work to address Representative Fields' questions in further detail. I know there was some provision with the follow-up offline. So, Mr. Ray Bung.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Sam Ray Bung. I'm the Director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Representative Fields, through the chair, I thought we sent the follow-up here, but the limited entry permit they're limited in regulation to, and I'm reading it off now. I don't have it in my head. Sorry, 545 commercial drift gill net salmon permits, 686 set gill net permits, and 68 purse seine permits. This is for the Cook Inlet area. There are no purse seine fisheries in Upper Cook Inlet, and there are no drift gillnet fisheries in Lower Cook Inlet or Resurrection Bay. But there are set gillnet fisheries in both Upper and Lower Cook Inlet. The majority of the pink salmon are harvested in the purse seine fisheries in Lower Cook Inlet, but in many years, the set net fishery actually harvests more pink salmon than the seine fishery does. All of the permit holders who make salmon landings pay the salmon enhancement tax. They voted on that. The Area H was voted on in 1988, I believe, and it's a 2% salmon enhancement tax for all commercial landings in Area H.
Okay, and following.
Right.
Sorry, Mr. Raybong, did you have any more information?
Well, I was going to add that the sockeye produced and released from the Tutka Bay Lagoon Hatchery also are contributing to Lower Cook Inlet set and seine fisheries.
Thank you, Mr. Raybung. Follow-up, Representative Fields.
Okay, well, I guess now I'm a little confused because I thought this was primarily a pink hatchery, but maybe you could provide clarity on how many sockeyes actually come out of the hatchery. But I was going to ask, what is the value of reds and silvers versus pinks in Cook Inlet and Kachemak Bay?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I don't have that figure in front of me. Obviously, sockeye are more valuable per pound. Pink salmon typically make up in volume. Pink salmon are the second highest value salmon in the state, statewide. Sockeye are the highest, of course, when you take into account Bristol Bay. And I'm trying to remember the rest of your question. I don't know exactly how much what the breakdown is of what would contribute in the salmon enhancement tax, but typically since about 2000 and 2003-ish, the salmon enhancement tax revenue has only been on the order of $100,000 to $200,000 a year. So it's I'm not going to say insignificant for the program.
Mr. Raybung, can you restate your statement after you were saying that it's not considered insignificant? I think you froze up a little bit.
Sorry about that. Certainly, So what I said was, I believe the salmon enhancement tax revenue has only been between $100,000 and $200,000 a year in that ballpark for the last 20 years or so. And it's not insignificant, but it is not the largest contributor to paying for the operations.
Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Raybong. Any follow-up, Representative Fields?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members before we move into public testimony? Seeing or hearing none, we will now pivot over into public testimony. Public testimony is now open on House Bill 52. I'd like to ask those testifying to please keep their testimony to 2 minutes to allow everybody the opportunity. And for anyone interested in providing public testimony that's in the room, please be sure to sign in before 3 p.m. Finding my alarm here. Is there anyone in the room in regards to public testimony on House Bill 52? Seeing or hearing none, we'll pivot to those who are called in. Same rules apply. Please keep it to 2 minutes. Put your name on the record, your potential affiliation, and provide your public testimony. We'll start with Mr. Wes Humbird.
Thank you. My name is Wes Humbird. I'd like to make a comment before I start reading my report. Mr. Raybon did not give you the truthful answer when he said there's no con, that there's only fishermen in Cook Inlet. The seiners and drift fishermen share Chinitna Bay if it warrants that. So he needs to go back and do his homework. That is a combination fishery there in Upper Cook Inlet. Dear House Resource members, after 60 years of fishing crab, salmon, shrimp, with the time working with ADF&G as I was an ABO, assistant boat officer on the Pandalus, prompted me to write to you, and what I see is a deceptive bill before you. Representative Sarah Vance, House Bill 52, continues to put a hatchery burden on 1,100 active area permit holders in Upper Cook Inlet. It illegally authorizes exclusive right and privilege for Tutka Bay Pink Hatchery to exploit Katsumat Bay State Park. Vance knows full well 590 set netters, 502 drift businesses, and their crews are denied access to participate in exclusive, privileged, accessible Lower Cook Inlet Tutka Hatchery fishery. House Bill 52 sanctions Cook Inlet Aquaculture, self-serving, misappropriated $20 million of sockeye harvest from the upper inlet. In exchange, CIA failing, no benefit, boondoggles fishermen and bamboozles with misleading PR lip service, glossy annual reports, future promises, failed inaccessibility to the hatchery, disease and damage to the wild systems and species of concern. Yet CIA's annual $4,500,000 hatchery expense allows only 17 out of 1,109 area H fishermen access to its own, it's just their own private ATM. And the reason why I'm testifying is because it's a financial reason for me. This malfunctioning ATM is hemorrhaging $17 million out of control debt, loans, and resuscitated the failing inaccessibility and disease tucked to hatchery. This holds hostage all limited entry permits and their crew, robbing Peter to pay Paul. HB 52 obscures the misdealings of Cook Inlet Aquaculture insolvency. Using access and have no preference for, we have no preference for pink salmon. CIA's use of public trust wild fishery nursery as an ATM machine for self-serving must cease. It's irresponsible exclusive privilege. Tutka Hatchery is illegal, make other hatcheries look bad, and it needs to go away. Thank you for your time. I'll answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Humbird, for your public testimony. Next on the list, we have Jesse Nelson. Mr. Nelson or Ms. Nelson, I'm not sure. If you could please put your name on the record and continue with your public testimony.
Yes, Jesse Nelson here. I'm a 56-year resident of Homer and a sport and commercial fisherman, and I'm representing myself. I strongly support passage of HB 52 as being in the best interest of the state to cure the land disposal issue at Tutka Lagoon and to add acreage to the Cottonwood Eastland parking area to ease that burden on the residents that
where the park users park in their driveways and in on the roads there. There's also been comments about a fiscal note to this bill. If this bill does not pass and the hatchery is forced to close, there will be a cost to the state, as the law says the state, not the hatchery contractor, must demolish this state asset and return the site to its normal state. Also, if the hatchery is collateral for loans, that would also have to be paid for by the state. And there was some mention about not very many Saners participating, but each one of those Saners is a small business, and they employ 3 to 4 people. And so it's not insignificant to this area. They come in and buy fuel and groceries and supplies. So there might not be a lot of them, but it's important to this area. So for these reasons, I urge passage of HB 52. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Moving on in the queue, Beaver Nelson, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, and provide your public testimony.
Hello, my name is Beaver, Beaver Nelson, and Homer resident, and I'm representing myself and speaking in support of HB 52. I'm a former ADF&G research biologist, now a commercial fisherman, and I'm also a member of the Kachemak Bay State Park Citizens Advisory Board. However, I'm speaking for myself and not representing the State Parks Board at all. We all know that addressing the HB 52 is a land disposal issue is the main thing, and that had to be dealt with somehow, and they put together ADF&G, State Parks, and Department of Law. They worked together on this bill, and they're the most qualified people to deal with this. They know the ins and outs of the legislative process and how to make all this work so it will be new law if it passes. So I mean, I don't know who else you'd get better to actually get us all put together there. And I want to talk about the consequences of if you fail to pass 52. It's going to be likely cause the shutdown of the Tutka hatchery, and that will mean no cost recovery revenue from there. And the majority of the funding for Cook and aquaculture comes from from Tutka cost recovery on Pink Snap. And now the total losses that are going to happen, if that hatchery shuts down, you can say goodbye to the China Poot dipnet fishery, which represents a bunch of people that go over there and have fun every summer. The Tutka Lagoon sockeye sport fishery, where people flood into the lagoon to snag the reds that are in there waiting to be caught for cost recovery and for broodstock. And the possible loss of the Resurrection Bay sockeye sport fishery. Now, you talk about a big sport fishery. You ought to see Resurrection Bay during the 3 weeks in June when those sockeye are coming into Resurrection Bay. There's hundreds of people there catching the 6 fish a day or whatever, just nonstop. So anyway, and that could happen because the Trail Lake hatchery may have to be closed because the enhancement tax plus cost recovery is not enough to keep Trail Lakes open, more than likely, because it just takes too much money to run the whole program, Trail Lakes, without having that cost recovery revenue stream coming in. And therefore, I'm a strong supporter of HB 52, and I mean, there's just too many good things happen to too many people up here that appreciate being able to go catch sockeye. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Next in the queue, Kristen San Roman, if you could please put your name on the record, any affiliation, begin your public testimony.
Good afternoon, House Resources Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Kristen San Roman. I'm a resident of Homer, and I'm representing myself. I'm opposed to House Bill 52. I've been following this bill since last spring when it was heard in House Fisheries, and since then I've learned a lot about the Tutka Bay Lagoon hatchery and how my community feels about it. I feel like the opposition is pretty well reflected in the written testimonies and other means of public outreach you guys have received, and each user group has their own reasons for being against this bill. For example, the Set and DriftNet fleet don't like being used for collateral and funding for a business that they're not allowed to benefit from. Conservationists are concerned about the land losing its highest threshold of protection. Landowners in the park are upset over CIAA being poor neighbors and bad stewards of the land. Park users are unhappy about the park's draft management plan and the public process that went into creating it being overturned. Liberals and conservatives alike are upset over the Alaska government's valuable money being wasted on this operation. And the average citizen does not care to see millions of low-quality pink salmon crowding the bay. I am not anti-hatchery, but I am very pro-state parks and conservation. I am also very pro-community, and I believe what is most beneficial for our community is to give them what they clearly want here, and that is for the hatchery to move out of the state park. CIAA has had 30 years to try to prove that they can run the Tucker Bay Lagoon hatchery efficiently, but without accomplishing that, it is time for them to move on. The state park can achieve the highest and best use of that land in a manner that will benefit all Alaskans, and that is what we should be promoting. If HB 52 doesn't pass, then the hatchery operations will cease by 2031. The park's draft management plan outlines that the structures in the lagoon can be converted into a group camp facility where people can recreate, camp, gather for events, or utilize for educational purposes. There are so many possibilities there, and that would be a huge plus for the park and for Homer. I ask that you folks support the wishes of the Homer community and vote no on House Bill 52. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. San Roman. Next in the queue, Len Fabish. If you could please put your name on the record, any affiliation, and begin your public testimony.
My name is Len Fabich, and I'm here representing myself. I'm calling in support of House Bill 52 as written to cure the legal land disposal issue and state agencies have supported. I have fished Kachemak Bay for over 30 years, both commercially and sport. I'm currently one of the commercial seiners that participates in the fishery that's provided by Tutka Bay. I'm in full support of the land trade for the following reasons. One of them is usage. Tutka Bay Lagoon is not a destination point for hardly anyone that is not involved in the hatchery or sport fishing seeking red salmon. The area is very difficult to navigate and enter by the average boater. This land is being traded for more land that will have significantly more use on the road system. Tutka Bay Lagoon is not a destination point. Those against this land swap would like to tell you that commercial fishermen benefit very little from the Tutka Bay hatchery. I'm a Lower Cook and a seiner, and I can tell you that nearly the entire fleet fishes this fishery during the month of July for red salmon produced by this hatchery. It's an extremely important part of our fishery. In 2019, my entire season was spent fishing reds and pink salmon from this hatchery. Commercial fishermen do benefit. Trying to put red salmon dipnet fishery are produced in an effort utilizing two hatcheries, the collection and egg take being done at the Tutka Bay hatchery. I would venture to say that more man hours are spent in pursuit of red salmon than any other destination in the state park in July. It is an amazing and responsible for putting fish in the freezer for a huge number of people in this area. The fish are excess fish that are not caught by commercial fishing fleets. Fishing salmon produced and sold at a cost recovery at Tutka Bay is in a very large way helping to fund the red salmon production. Pink salmon are critical to the financing of this operation. Thank you for your consideration of House Bill 52.
Thank you, Mr. Fabish. Next in the queue, Penelope Haas, if you could please put your name on the record, residency and affiliation, and begin your public testimony.
Thank you, members of the House Resources Committee. My name is Penelope Haas. I live in Homer, Alaska. I am on the board of the Kachemak Bay Conservation Society, but I'm speaking for myself today. I've worked in Alaska commercial salmon fisheries for the past 13 years in Bristol Bay, Prince William Sound, and the Alaska Peninsula. I recreate, hunt, and fish in Kachemak Bay State Park, as do all of my friends. I appreciate your consideration of all of the complexity of these issues before you, and I am voicing my strong opposition to HB 52. I just want to say that if you look at the public record, I think it reflects the essential sentiment in this town of what people want. There are only two people who have voiced their support of this bill for the entire public record. And there are, you know, over 250, I think I counted, people who want to see this bill go away, who do not support HB 52. The reasons the Commissioner of Fish and Game and the Commissioner of DNR have said that they support this bill is to stop DNR from having to manage a hatchery. That will happen if HB 52 does not pass. DNR will be able to stop managing this hatchery if this does not pass. So I wanted to point that out. I also urge you to look at all the public testimony that shows why the sockeye fishery is not tied to the pink salmon fishery. And I want to emphasize that this hatchery is not in any way supporting commercial fishermen in any meaningful way. Lower Cook Inlet set netters and seiners are catching about 97.5% of their fish from other fisheries. And that is a very important fact, and we've, Kachemak Bay Conservation Society has provided charts to support that. We want to conclude by just reminding you that these are public lands, and we urge you to manage them in a way that is most beneficial to the public interest, that is closing the Tucker Bay Lagoon Hatchery. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Haas. Moving on, Gordon Vernon, if you could please put your name on the record, residency affiliation, and begin your public testimony.
Hello, my name is Robert Vernon, and I am from Homer, Alaska. Honorable members of the Resource Committee, if you think that diving into one of the three original state parks in Alaska to extract 123 acres of land to give to a group of private seiners that want to put a financially failing Humpy farm in the middle of a state park is reasonable, that's like cutting through your sternum when you could have done the surgery laparoscopically. That's like putting a locust farm in the middle of wheat fields. That's wondering where all the water went when you pumped the well dry. If you don't understand other fishermen's take on this, then call Paul Seaton, who was a gill netter in Cook Inlet, ran a tender for the Lagoon Hatchery, and used to be on the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Board. If you don't understand the financial drain the Tucker Bay Hatchery is on the state, then call John Faulkner, who is a deputy commissioner of the Commerce and owns a tourist hotel half the distance from the Humpy Hatchery at the proposed parking lot. If you want a character reference on the proposed owners of the Kachemak Bay State Park, call Judge Margaret Miller, who sentenced three of the CIAA board 3 years ago for fishing in illegal grounds, herding schools of salmon and driving them into seine nets, and you can bet they weren't Humpies. And they still are on the board of CIAA and have their hands out for these treasured parklands. If you don't understand how this deal rewards the biggest polluter in the state park, a park that is supposed to guard the pristine nature of a small piece of Cook Inlet, then I don't think you see where humanity and House Bill 52 are headed. So maybe I'm going to say some things that you don't want to hear, but in 20 years when they ask who was Sarah Vance, I hope I can say that she was a misguided legislator who tried to play God, choosing which species would prosper and which were spawned out. I hope I can say that she was a poorly informed minion that tried to carry out the edicts during the Caliphate of Dunleavy. I hope I can say that she was a deluded daughter of God.
Mr. Vernon, I'd like to caution you to making defaming remarks about our legislators. It's one thing to disagree politically, but to attack the character of somebody, that's something that I'm not willing to tolerate. And you have reached your two-minute mark. If you can please wrap up your comments.
I pray that I don't have to say that she was the representative that perpetrated the rape of Kachemak Bay State Park. She took
Thank you, Mr. Vernon.
Park and enshrined them.
Talia, can we move to the next testifier, please? Next testifier on the line is Bruce Friend. If you could please put your name on the record, your residency, your affiliation, and provide your public testimony, and please abide by the common sense rules of testifying, please. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Bruce Friend. Thank you for taking the time to hear my comments. I first want to go on the record as saying that I strongly oppose HB 52. I have been a resident of Homer for 7 years. I've been a property owner in Big Tutka Bay for since 1983, and I've watched the devastation, I guess I would say, of Tutka Bay Lagoon. When I first started going there, there were many species of crab, shrimp, clams, and what we see now is a completely desolate lagoon over there. The bottom of the lagoon is anaerobic. There are no species that can survive there in the underwater environment. This extends on out into Big Tutka Bay, and we've seen the current operation of CIAA contribute to that disintegration outside of the bay by dumping illegally dumping carcasses in front of my cabin and placing net pens at the head of the bay when they were not permitted to do so. I strongly encourage you to think about the future of the bay and the users that are over there. There's been testimony so far that says that people don't or can't navigate up into that lagoon. I would completely disagree with that. And I find myself up there numerous times a year. I look forward to you looking at the financial and fiscal responsibilities by referring this to the House Finance Committee. I'll conclude my testimony here by having you understand that 30 years of failed operations and failure to take care of our Alaska State or Ketchumak Bay State Park is beyond, it's just a bridge too far. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Friend. Next in the queue, we have Robert Archibald. If you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, residency, and begin your public testimony.
Thank you, Chair Pocock. Committee members, for the record, my name is Robert Archibald. I'm the current chair of Ketchumak Bay State Park Citizens Advisory Board. On February 9th of this month, we had our last meeting. We had folks from DPOR, DNR, and Rep. Dance at our meeting discussing HB 52, committee substitute. We had a good discussion, and at the end of that, we had a vote of 11 yes and 2 no to move our resolution to your board, which hopefully you all have received in opposition to this bill. A point that I would also like to make on the lands in the Cottonwood Eastland area. There are three parcels out there, A, B, and C. B has got a deed restriction on it that limits its use to Ketchumak Bay State Park. Parcel C has a conservation easement on it. Parcel A has had ILMA put in on that, and it was paid for by Friends of Ketchumak Bay State Park. So there is things moving in that direction, and the state park system manages parcel A, B and C currently. So it has been a long process with the Ketchumak Bay State Park management plan, and the State Park Citizens Advisory Board is in favor of currently the way that state park management plan is written, which phases Tutka Bay Lagoon Hatchery out. Thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Archibald. Next in the queue, Delana West, actually unavailable. After that is Roberta Highland. Roberta, if you could please put your name on the record, your affiliation, residency, and begin your public testimony.
Yes, my name is Roberta Highland. I live in Homer, and I'm representing myself. I strongly oppose HB 52. I admire fishermen and fisherwomen and responsible fisheries and hatcheries, but not all hatcheries are equal. TBLH has had years of problems, and this has really never been the right spot for this hatchery. This bill deserves close scrutiny because since the 1970s, TBLH, operated by CIAA, has been working under an illegal agreement between parties. So HB 52 attempts to fix a problem from long ago, plus now, asking Alaskan citizens to pay dearly for this mistake by the unjust loss of a spectacular part of our park. CIAA has had a bad financial track record. Not just the TBLH's losses, but an outstanding debt to the state of $16 million. Closing of the TBLH will help them cut their losses of $600,000 to $1 million per year. These losses just at TBLH alone. TBLH has caused environmental damage to a once rich nursery for crab, shrimp, clams, And as you heard also, historically large-scale illegal fish carcass dumping in Tutka Bay. The removal of the 123 acres, and I don't understand why so many acres, the original ILMA is 6.84 acres from Kachemak Bay State Park. That's a dangerous precedent, allowing industrial or commercial operations to supersede state parks' protections. I do support a separate bill adding the East End property. There are enough legal questions I personally have about HB 52 and past agreements, but I am seeking my own legal opinion. But again, I ask you to give this the special scrutiny it deserves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hyland. Next on the list, we have Steve Vanek. Mr. Vanek, please put your name on the record, affiliation, residency, and begin your public testimony.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine, sir.
Okay, good. I don't know. Yeah, my name is Steve Vanek. I live in Nanilchik, Alaska. I'm speaking for myself. I am 81 years old. I have been commercial fishing in Cook Inlet since 1966. I own an original limited entry drift permit. I'm a drift fisherman. I am the longest serving board member on the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. I have been a regional planning team member since the RPTs were begun. As a board member of Cook Inlet Aquaculture, and I'm speaking for myself, not the board, I voted to mothball Tutka Hatchery when we were getting 3 cents a pound for pinks. The processors didn't even want them from commercial fishermen. We didn't just abandon Tutka, which we could have done, but we maintained it so it could be reopened when the price increased, which we knew it would. Many of the objections to Tutka are from people who are anti-hatchery, and that has nothing to do with the location of Tutka Hatchery. What about the private inholdings in the park? A sawmill is going in opposite the hatchery right now. What about a lodge? Are those things all right in a state park? Tutka Hatchery is a business that depends on many support industries. In a time when oil is no longer king, are we going to get rid of another fishing business? Don't be short-sighted in your thinking or overwhelmed by someone's emotional arguments, which you've heard today. Why would somebody go into Tutka Lagoon if there's nothing there? Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Mr. Vanek.
Can I ask you a question?
Representative Rocher.
Just for the record, sir, is that a yes or a no?
Mr. Vanek, if you could please clarify your stance on HB 52.
Oh, okay. I thought it was obvious, but that's all right. No, I am for 52, and I think Sarah Vance has done a remarkable job in negotiating all the different things that go into this bill. I think it's really a very well thought out of and well published bill, and I would certainly hope you would pass that and not be let emotional people.
Thank you for your answer.
Emotional, but okay.
Thank you, Mr. Vanek. Rejoining us, who was earlier in the queue, listed as unavailable, Rod Van Son. If you could please put your name on the record, residency, affiliation, and begin your public testimony.
Yes, my name is Rod Van Son, and I am a resident of Nanilchik, and I'd like to thank the chairperson and the board for hearing my testimony on HB 52. I am in support of it. I have been fishing Nanilchik, Kachemak Bay, and Cook Inlet for over 30 years, probably on average 80 to 100 days a year. as a commercial fisherman, but mostly as a charter fisherman. I've set net, seined, worked in processing, and sport fish and chartered. So I think my insight is very valuable. One of the things I'd like to defuse is the misinformation about how much sport fishermen depend on the pinks. And as a guide, I used to use them a lot. My clients loved it from all over the state and from all over the country. And it was a vital part of my operation. Also, as a commercial fisherman, there are years, if we did not have Tuska, I would not have been in existence. And that continues to be true. Another thing that bothers me about this is that people are saying that the dip netters will not lose their sockeyes. That is not the truth. The truth is the sockeyes in Resurrection Bay, the sockeyes in China Poot, and the sockeyes in Tutka will all go away. This Tutka is incredibly important for funding those programs to benefit Alaskans from all over the state. And a plethora of people that come and dip net those fish and snag those fish and depend on that. It also takes pressure off the Kenai and pressure off the Kasiwa. It also gives the people of Homer and Seward fisheries that they otherwise would not have where they can get their sockeye. The importance of passing HB 52 can't be overstated. It's got to go through, and I really appreciate the work that Sarah's done, Sarah Vance, and also the other members, and I appreciate you hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Vanson. Next in the queue, David Martin, if you could please identify yourself on the record, provide your affiliation and residency, and begin your public testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is David Martin. I'm from Clam Gulch, Alaska, and I am representing myself. Although I'm active in several commercial fishing organizations and a board member of Cookin Aquaculture Association since the 1980s. I also have commercial drift fishing in Cook Inlet for 50 years, including seining in Tutka, China Poot, and Lower Cook Inlet. I've been directly involved in all aquaculture activities, plus on the regional planning team that scrutinizes aquaculture and state hatchery programs for compliance with state policy and law, using the best science and genetic information available. This is a matter of fixing a constitutional land disposal issue, and I strongly support House Bill 52. It resolves this legal issue. There will be thousands of people benefit from this, except for the small group that opposes hatcheries and have used this forum to try to close the hatchery at Tutka, as they have tried for years. Strictly on hearsay and theories, they are entitled to their opinions and questions, but please verify with the facts. I have heard a lot of misinformation and downright lies today. The Tutka hatchery is one spoke in the wheel of aquaculture's multiple hatcheries and projects. All resources are used to fund all projects. Some resources avenues generate more than others depending on the year and the circumstances. One classic example is funds from the hatcheries have supported decades of invasive pike suppression in the Susitna drainage, which has resulted in 1.7 million adult sockeye returning for harvest by the common property fisheries. That otherwise would have been eaten by the invasive pike. That doesn't include the savings of silvers, kings, chums, and pinks, and from the beaver dam removal that aquaculture has done for decades. I would say that I am proud and have been paying my 2% aquaculture tax, and I've paid thousands of dollars into it. As far as viewscape goes, I enjoy seeing net pens and fish, and so do tourists. They watch the fishermen fish, so it's not just one opinion of viewscape. And hardly any of the people that are objective of this have I seen through the aquaculture board meetings or the regional planning team meetings. So this is a small area on the side of the park.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Please wrap up your comments.
Okay. I'd say it's on the side of the park. It's a 2-to-1 land swap, basically. It's a win for all people involved, and I would support you guys unanimously approving this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Next on the list, we've got Liz Mehring. Liz, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, and residency, and begin your public testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Liz Mehring, and I'm calling in from Homer, Alaska, on behalf of Cook Inlet Keeper, which is a community-based organization of 8,500 members and supporters dedicated to the protections of the Cook Inlet watershed and the life it sustains. I wanted to speak to you all today directly about the land issues that come up with HB 52 and Inlet Keeper's opposition to this proposed bill. I would note to start that Inlet Keeper and the public only had 4 days to prepare comments to the new version of this bill, which is inadequate public notice for this issue, particularly when it would override an extensive public process in order to come up with the Ketchumek Bay State Park Management Plan. To this day, we still don't understand, and nor has the Game and Fish or Representative Vance's office been able to answer why there's been an increase in acreage from the original ILMA from 6.84 acres to the current bill, which would remove 123.45 acres. We have repeatedly asked for original maps and other information on why there's been an increase. We've heard different answers, such as some more upland, the water's being included, but it's very unclear why there's been this increase and why it's necessary. I would also note that there has been a lot of discussion about the guarantees that the new version of the bill provides to the public, but I do not believe that the text actually provides those guarantees. There's no guarantee that we will, as the public, continue to have access. It's not written in the bill. There's no guarantee that DNR couldn't sell the land under their management operations. There's no guarantee what the status of the land would be when it was returned to state parklands if it happened in the future. I would also note that the fiscal note that's attached to the bill is wholly inadequate for the public. It does not reflect the current status of the bill, and that should be updated to reflect that status and providing important information to the public. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and Inlet Keeper would urge you to not pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mehring. Next on the queue, we've got Malcolm Milne. Malcolm, if you could please put your name on the record, residency, affiliation, and begin your public testimony.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yep. Okay, thank you. Yep, so my name is Malcolm Milne, and I'm a Lower Cook Inlet Seine permit holder. I own and operate a seiner and a fish salmon for Cook Inlet since 2010. I also fished briefly in 1995 here. I'm currently the first vice president of the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association, president of the local Homer Fishing Organization, North Pacific Fisheries Association, and I'm a member of the Cook Inlet Tamers Association. I also sit on the Homer Fish and Game Advisory Committee. I support HB 52 as a cure to the land disposal issue between the state of Alaska Department of Natural Resources and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Please see this issue for what it is, even though much of the opposition seems to be directed at the site's contractor, Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. This is a land disposal issue, which needs a solution, and I appreciate the sponsor for bringing this forward. The CIA Board of Directors consists of Cook Inlet, which is area aged fishermen of all deer types, as well as municipal representatives. I sent a comment letter in attached with our bylaws, which describes the Board of Directors, but a majority of the Board of Directors need to be area age permit holders, and we have deer groups which represent drifters, seiners, and set netters, all on the Board of Directors. These are decisions that are made on our behalf by fishermen, for fishermen. This bill is not a venue or a trial for the hatcheries, and there's a lot of misinformation stated today. I'm sure you all, as legislators, have good sifters, and I hope to break them out for this one. At the 2019 Alaska Board of Fisheries, Lower Cook Inlet Finfish meeting, a number of proposals directly targeted to Tucker Bay Lagoon Hatchery, all of which failed. When the information is presented to a scientifically based evidence body, delivered a body such as the Board of Fisheries, Tucker Bay Hatchery Lagoon prevails. As a CIA board member, I'm well aware that we have a lot of room for improvement, and we work towards that every day. And when we're not spending our time fending off attacks. In 2018, the DNR adopted a management plan for Ketchumek Bay State Park that continues the compatible use determination for Tucker Bay Lagoon Hatchery. the land disposal issue seems to look like a more recent development, and that plan was rescinded by when this administration came to was elected. So that history, I don't think it's been fully brought out here, but it has been. As one of the questions today touched on that. But finally, I just want to say a lot of time and energy has gone into attacking children aquaculture and Tucker Bay hatchery. People very seldom attend our meetings or engage in a constructive manner. If a portion of that energy was directed at being collaborative and actually building community instead of dividing it, I think we'd all be better off. I am available to discuss the merits of the hatchery at any time and provided my contact information with my comment letter. And invite any member of the public to contact me as well if you want to discuss the actual merits of the bay, of the hatchery itself, instead of just throwing stones at each other. So thank you all for your time, and I appreciate your consideration, and I support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Milne. Next in the queue, Kevin Walker, if you could please put your name on the record, identify your residency and affiliation, and begin with your public testimony.
Hello, I'm Kevin Walker. I live in Homer. I worked for CIAA for several seasons at the Trail Lake Hatchery. I'm on the Catch Bay State Parks' advisory board, but I'm representing myself. There is a resolution that was passed, as Robert mentioned earlier in this broadcast. The Shinnepook dipnet fishery does not depend on Tucker Bay Lagoon Hatchery. The Tucker Bay Hatchery was totally closed from 2003 until 2011, 7 years, with no expenses shown. Between 2005 and 2010, with the Tucker hatchery closed, between 100,000 and 500,000 sockeye were released into the Shinnepook system, according to the 2021 annual management plan from the last Department of Fish and Game. Trail Lake's hatchery is responsible for incubating these fish. No sockeye salmon have been in the Tucker Bay hatchery for many years due to diseases in the water. The sockeye cannot survive in the Tucker Bay hatchery. If anyone claims that the Shinnepook sockeye dipnet fishery will close, please ask them how these hundreds of thousands of fish got into the Shinnepook system each year, even with the hatchery closed 7 years in a row. It has been done. HB 52 would benefit a teeny fraction of the fishermen who must pay in the CIA to support the hatchery. 97% of fishermen who pay this fee get absolutely no benefit from the hatchery. Most of the fish goes to cost recovery. The land to be traded in this bill is already owned by Alaska Department of Natural Resources. The Friends of Kachemak Bay State Park has paid the $2,400 fee to initiate a land transfer to include this land into the Kachemak Bay State Park. This is from local citizens who support the park. No trading is needed. The process has begun several years ago. Tucker Bay Hatchery should be repurposed into an educational youth camp, rental cabins, or other park facility compatible with outdoor recreation. CIAA has shown that a pink salmon hatchery in Tucker Bay benefits only a few past recovery fishermen. HB 52 is unaccessible. Reject the bill and stick with the original intent to adopt management plan for the park. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Next in the queue, we've got Alan Parks. Please identify yourself, any affiliation and residency, and begin your public testimony.
Hang on. I've got to call you back. Hello. This is Alan Parks. Are you, am I on the line now?
Yes, Mr. Parks, you are on the line, and hello to your mom.
Oh, thank you. My name's Alan Parks. My comments today are my own. I'd like to start off by saying thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. I'm a retired, close to 40-year veteran of Alaska commercial fisheries. As a young boy, I fished Lower Cook Inlet. I had a permit and a boat. I went in and out of the lagoon all the time under the Fred Division when it first started operating. I oppose HB 52 for a lot of reasons. Probably the most emotional one is that the degradation and the poor stewardship of CIAA has destroyed the lagoon. I outlined that in a document that I submitted to you guys. The other concerns I have is the loans that they have with the DCCED and the inappropriateness, I feel, of the state of Alaska allowing state property to be used as collateral for one of CIA loans. I think that's really inappropriate. I submitted that in a chart, flow chart to you there's a lot of violations, or there's not a lot. There's a few kind of major violations that CIA has infringed on the state park land outside of the ILMA, or the land agreement, the ILMA, with the Department of Fish and Game and DNR, which CIA operates under. So they've infringed by over a half an acre onto the parkland out of that land agreement. And I guess just to wrap it up, I think there's a lot of details associated with this project, and everything about it is just really complex and dynamic, and to take a real thorough look at what everybody is saying and what they're submitting as their version of the truth. I've tried to really be factual in what I've submitted to you guys, and so I hope that you are careful in reviewing it. And like I said, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parks. Next on the list is Brent Johnson. Please put your name on the record, identify your residency and affiliation, and begin your public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Brent Johnson. Speaking for myself, I was born in Seldovia, been a set netter since 1962. I appreciate Representative Vance's HB 52. She has my compliments for the work on it and the good job she's done. So I been a cooking and aquaculture member. I was president of the board for 15 years. And as I said, I've been set netting since 1962. The fish that I catch don't have anything to do directly with Petka Bay Lagoon Hatchery. So I don't have a direct financial link, but the work that Cooking and Aquaculture does directly supports what I do, and that particular hatchery directly supports what I do. In a way, because the processors depend on having fish so that they can stay in business, and the Petka Bay Hatchery produces fish that helps them stay in business. As you're probably well aware of, we've had some disaster years in the upper inlet, and processors, there are now fewer of them in Kenai than there ever have been since the beginning of the fishery. So they definitely need those fish, and I need them to stay in business so that when I do catch fish, I have someone to sell my fish to. My neighbor catches sockeye. He's a sport fisherman. He catches the Petka Bay sockeye itself, not the China Poot dip net fishery. And so he's one of numerous people that depend on those sockeye. And from my experience, I directly believe that if the Cricket and Aquaculture loses Petka Bay hatchery, that there will be no more sockeye in either China Poot or Petka Bay. So somebody mentioned that these are low-quality pinks, and actually they're high-quality pinks. My time's up. I'm glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Next on the list, we've got Nancy Hillstrand. Nancy, if you could please put your name on the record, your affiliation and residency, and begin your public testimony.
Yes, hello. My name is Nancy Hillstrand. I've been a resident for 48 years in Homer and Kodiak, 45 years in the fisheries. I've worked at the Tutka Hatchery actually for 11 years, and I'm owner-operator of Coal Point Seafoods, as well as Pioneer Alaskan Fisheries, which is a almost 60-year-old corporation. I'm calling because I wanted you to know that the disposal and compatibility issues have already been cured with the solution found after 8 long years of revising the Department of Natural Resources Kachemak Bay Management Plan. This was a long process that determined that the best thing to do was to phase out the inefficient hatchery. Doing this would cure all of the incompatible issues, such as the chronic strife that we've been going through in the park board, the residents having major strife and controversy issues with the hatchery, and just multiple problems it cures. And also, there's what I think is 3 big issues and 3 big questions that need to be thought of with House Bill 52, which I completely am in opposition of. The first one is, does HB 52 serve the highest and best use to assure the greatest utilization and development of a state-owned facility? The second one would be, does HB 52 authorize exclusive use of fisheries, just allowing 17 people to be able to have access to these fish compared to the 1,100 other fishermen in the Cook Inlet Area H, Cook Inlet fisheries? And the third one would be, does HB 52 promote inefficient aquaculture? And when you look at $17 million in debt that all the fishermen are being put through, this kind of attests to something that we need to look into to make sure we're upholding our Constitution. Because all of these issues have to do with the Constitution, and I think HB 52 is not constitutional, and I oppose HB 52. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hillstrand. Jeffrey Lee, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, residency, and begin your public testimony. And actually, before you do that, I'd like to note that written testimony is still being taken, so those of you who may have gone over the allotted time in today's testimony, please feel free to send in your written testimony so the committee members can see that. Mr. Lee, please.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Awesome. My name is Jeff Lee. I'm a Sylvovia resident. I'm here testifying for myself. I'm also a Citizens Advisory Board member on the park for a while now, I think 8 or 9 years. It's put me in an interesting position where I've been on the forefront of this battle now that's been raging since 2011. And let me assure you that it's been raging with Cook Inlet aquaculture. It's been nothing but conflict and strife for years. And the board has had to face a lot of this. I'm opposed to HB 52. There's one chronic thing through this whole 12 years has been the misleading information or half information. On this, to kind of demolish this, some of the land disposal issues, which you've heard, are already being solved. They've been solved by this management plan, trying that's about ready to come to do nothing. All these issues, the HB 52 is disposal will be taken care of by doing nothing. The Cottonwood Eastland land as a land swap is just simply a grab because you have to swap one for the other. That's moving along just fine. That doesn't need it. The red salmon program, they're separate. When we can eliminate this, so there's lots of ways that state parks in the future can work to continue that program. There are different issues now than the 10 years before, but they're still, they're not together. You know, the who this serves, it's really like it's the 17 seniors at the most. You know, when you're looking at just the fisheries, not even the park side, you know, the 1,092 that have no access to this, it's 1% of the people that benefit from this. I mean, there's just so many different things that can move forward. The management plan, if it follows through, is opening up a huge area for future growth in the parks for everybody, not just one group. And I'm opposed to HB 52. Please squash this now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Earl Hopper, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, residency, and provide your public testimony.
Yeah, my name is Earl Hopper, and I am calling in to say that I support HB 52 as written to cure the legal land disposal issue that the state agency support. Me and my family use that every year. We go dip netting up there. My wife, my two small children, my sister, my mother. You know, we fill our freezers with that every year, and it would just be a crying shame to see it go away. We have a little inflatable. We go up there, and you know, we let kids swim in the water. You know, when it's warm enough, but they're Alaskan kids, so it's almost always warm enough. But I would really hate to not be able to go up there and get those fish because it is a big part of our diet, and we really benefit from it. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Hopper. Alan Davis, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, residency, and begin your public testimony.
I'm Alan Davis from Anchor Point, and I'm representing myself. I'm calling in support of HB 52 and Representative Vance, and I'd like to say these personal attacks against her I've heard today are reprehensible.
I think this fishery is an important local resource. I and a lot of people I know take advantage of it, and I think it takes a significant amount of pressure off of the Kenai and Kasilof dip net fisheries, as well as providing a local economic opportunity. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Chris Burrows, if you can please put your name on the record, state your affiliation and residency, and begin your public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Chris Burrows. I'm the president of Pacific Seafood Processors Association, and testifying on behalf of members who operate in Alaska coastal communities across the state and across Alaska. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 52 as a solution to the land issues that are associated with the Ketchumet Bay State Park Plan, and also the need to continue operations of the Ketchumet Bay Lagoon Hatchery. The 1995 management plan identified fisheries and catchment as a goal for Ketchumet Bay State Park, and compatible under permit, focused on fishing as a critical recreational and commercial activity in the park and in Ketchumet Bay specifically. Any changes to the park plan that would end operations at the Ketchumet Bay hatchery would impact communities and permit holders who've already faced years of economic hardship. Our commercial fishermen and fish processors in South Central make up a vital backbone of local communities, employing 11,500 workers and contracting with local vendors and other service providers. This is quite an integrated, coordinated, and supplemental activity that happens that supports many different types of activities and economic value across this region. A breadth of fisheries users, recreational, personal use, commercial, and as we heard today, also sport is significant in its reliance on this hatchery and in this area, and has been for decades. Removing recreational opportunities for Alaskans and employment opportunities for Alaskans will remove some of the base of these local economies. It is unnecessary and is unwarranted. Now, this bill resolves an issue that results in the support of these jobs, the revenue created by the hatchery, the infrastructure that's supported from support entities, and also the volume that's necessary for us to be able to continue processing operations in this day and age. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 52, encourage your support of it, and please let me know if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burrows. Chris Perry, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, and residency, and begin your public testimony.
My name is Chris Perry. I've shortened this testimony for time's sake, but I've included full written testimony many members by email. I've been a commercial fisherman and lived in Homer, commercial fish in Upper and Lower Cook Inlet for the last 39 years. I'm asking you to approve House Bill 52 to help protect Ketchumet Bay Hatchery in the state park as it was established to provide enjoyment and opportunity to all. Ketchumet Bay Hatchery is a benefit to all Alaska residents and visitors. The hatchery's contributions to personal use sport, commercial fisheries, and Ketchumet Bay are substantial. China Poot Fishery residents are allowed to take 12 fish per day with no annual limit. With closure of Ketchumet Bay hatcheries, these fisheries will close, and the majority of the present user groups are unaware of this possible closure. It should be noted that Cook Inlet Aquaculture pays for entire cost for these stocking projects. Ketchumet Bay hatchery closure will also close all sanding in Ketchumet Bay, as there are no other sockeye and limited small pink salmon returns in the area. Ketchumet Bay is a very small hatchery relative to all other pink salmon hatcheries around the state. Many of the negative biological impacts people promote are not scientifically proven and are still under intense research. They're very productive shellfish and finfish fisheries in close proximity to large hatcheries in Prince William Sound in southeast Alaska that have been in production for many years. There have been as many as 84 salmon seine permits in Lower Cook Inlet. Throughout the 1980s, there were between 52 and 83 seine permits fished. In the 2000s, there were only between 15 and 36 fished, and that's mainly due to Ketchumet Bay hatchery temporary closure. As many Alaskans and scientists know, each year salmon returns can be substantially different. This is the strength of the species. One year can be the worst, and the very next year can be the very best return ever. In conclusion, House Bill 52 is a bill addressing land disposal issues in the park and should not be considered as reason to close Ketchumet Bay hatchery, as some people are doing. not allow increased Tuckta Bay hatchery production or expansion into other parts of the park, and it does not change any current public use of the lagoon or existing land the Tuckta Bay hatchery is on. If Tuckta Bay hatchery closes, there are far-reaching negative impacts for all Alaska residents, sport, personal, commercial fishermen, and tourists alike. Many thousands of these people do not realize the potential changes. And thank you for your time and consideration. Please don't hesitate to contact me for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Holly Norwood, if you could please put your name on the record, provide your affiliation and residency.
And Clifford Norwood was here, but he had to go start snow blowing. I've been in Alaska since 1985. He's been here since 79. We started in Homer. Our Homer cabin is still there. We're there all summer, but we also live in Nikiski. So we're kind of your generic Kenai Peninsula resident that doesn't commercial fish or is involved that much with the environmental community. We are for keeping Tuckta Bay hatchery open. It sounds like that means we support the bill. What caught our attention was the inability then, if it's closed, of course, to get our sockeye. And at both Tuckta and Chinaput, because we depend on that for food security. Like all Alaskans, I know 50 ways to cook salmon. And I do think there would be more of us calling in to say this if we knew about that, that was going to be closed. You know, I don't know why, how you get the word out, but I don't think those of us depending on it for food are being heard on this. Now, you can't walk around Homer. I disagree that all of Homer supports this. That's just supports closing the Tuckta hatchery. That's just not the case. But certainly there's people we respect on both sides. And, you know, those that want to close it, they've got hunches that, you know, the pink fry are competing with the salmon and the pinks are hurting the wild pinks and that the herring and crab is gone because of this hatchery. But the science just doesn't seem to support that because, you know, we would pay attention to that. Anyway, we're for keeping the Tuckta Bay hatchery open.
Thank you, Ms. Norwood. Representative Fields?
I don't know if it's possible to go back to Mr. Raybong at this time, but how did the Chinaput dipnet fishery stay open when the this hatchery was not producing for, I guess, that nine-year period? I just don't know the details on that.
Thank you, Representative Fields. I believe Mr. Raybong, along with the bill sponsor, are taking notes to address questions once we exit public testimony, so we'll add that to the list. Sue Christensen, if you could please put your name on the record, state your affiliation and residency, and begin with your public testimony.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time and energy in trying to understand this complicated bill. I live in Homer. I, like Sarah Vance, have been here for more than 40 years. I own a cabin adjacent to the state park. I have been a commercial fisherwoman. I was the co-founder of the Kitimat Heritage Land Trust. I am on the state park board, but I am not speaking on their behalf. I'm a Quaker, so this is really, Heber is also on our state park board and on the Cook Inlet board. And like, he's one of my favorite people on earth. I'm not comfortable attacking, and I agree that personal attacks are reprehensible, and I just apologize to Representative Vance, and I salute her for her work on this. However, one of my favorite places on earth is Tuckta Bay Lagoon. It meets every unique scenic criteria that our state park was designated by legislators who had foresight for being just one of the most knock-your-socks-off beautiful places on earth. It does not in any way is a trade for land for a parking lot across the bay, you know, that is inaccessible, undeveloped canyons, you know, parking lot land for this is like $1 million waterfront property that we're talking about that would make an excellent headquarters for a UNESCO, United Nations, bioregional reserve. We are in the process of applying for that. It's going to be a long period. I'd like to just remind everybody that we're not talking about if this bill doesn't pass, if you let it die today, the hatchery is going to be open. We have 10 years to come up with a better solution. A bioregional reserve is about balancing relationships between development and economic, fostering economic and human development that's ecologically sustainable. And I think that's the best use for Tutka Bay Lagoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Dean Day, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation and residency, and begin your public testimony. Mr. Dean Day.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm sorry. My name is Dean Day. I'm the executive director of Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. I appreciate the opportunity to provide this testimony, and I would be happy to answer any questions, as I'm sure there will be some. You know, HB 52, I'm testifying in support of HB 52. HB 52 resolves the land disposal issue that was highlighted in the new intent to adopt version of the park management plan, deeming the hatchery incompatible when the hatchery has operated in the park under the designation of being compatible for decades and under multiple park management plans. If the hatchery was no longer operational, the China dipnet fishery goes away, along with all sockeye enhancement in the Lower Cook Inlet to include Hazel Lake, Kirshner Lake, and Tutka Bay Lagoon fishery. I submitted some documentation on Monday with a description of the complexity of the China Poop project. And what you have is fact, and that is what is involved with the China Poop project itself. So other statements that other places can do it, Trail Lakes Hatchery can do it. Trail Lakes Hatchery is an integral part of the project, but it cannot do the project itself. Statements regarding the program taking place during the closure are true, but still required the facility to be operational and staffed seasonally, which means we had to pay electric bills, insurance, maintenance, upkeep, continue to be paid by CIA during the entire period of shutdown for the project to continue, and it never was designated to be a standalone project. The sockeye program is costly and comes with a risk, thus requires pink salmon returns for funding for the project to be sustainable. CIA is governed by a 26-member, all-volunteer board of directors made up of multiple stakeholders who determine the funding for the projects. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Day. Paul Shadura, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, residency, and begin your public testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Pat Patak and the House Resources Committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Paul A. Shadura II. I'm a fourth-generation Alaskan, and I've been commercial fishing for 55 years. I live in the Kalifornsky, Alaska area. I'm a board director of Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association, had it since the late 70s, but I am not representing them in this discussion. I want to thank and support Representative Vance for addressing the possible inconsistencies in the proposed park management plan. Our completed standard agreement dated 5/2014 in Appendix C establishes a contracted period of 20 years expiring June 30th, 2031. In addition, Provision 4 allows for a contract renewal upon request. We are contracted to operate the Tutka Bay facilities under the Department of Fish and Game strict permit guidelines and the Comprehensive Regional Cook Inlet Management Plan. As a board director, I'm well aware of our fiduciary responsibilities and had assumed that in order to enter into the revolving loan fund to further improve CIA facilities and operations, that CIA had a long-term commitment from the state to be able to pay back these loans through the cost recovery process. CIA is not a single operation, or rather a comprehensive one that affects all areas of Cook Inlet and Resurrection Bay. Like a ship that stays afloat, long as all of your hull planks stay in place. An example of how it affects your federal legislators, I just wanted to comment how our facilities are just finished and at Resurrection Bay. For instance, District Representative Stutes has two facilities and in her area. One of them is the Tampa Bay facility and the other Port Grant. Representative Carpenter, District 29, has two facilities. Representative Gillum, District 30, has one facility. District 12, Representative Tilton, has one facility. 31, Representative Vance, we do field work and assessments on the Kasilof River. District 10, Representative Eastman, field work. District 8, Representative McCabe, field work. So, frankly, the operation of Cook Inlet Aquaculture through the Tutka Bay is just one part, but a very important part, to maintain the operation and continue with its solvency. Cook Inlet Aquaculture is a non-profit regional association.
Mr. Shadura, if you could please wrap up your comments.
Can I make 4 points?
Mr. Shadura, we've applied a time limit to each member that's wanting to provide public testimony as to everybody getting a chance to, and you've expired your 2 minutes. I would like to remind you that until the committee moves the bill, if we decide to, written testimony will be allowed to be provided to the committee members. With that, Mago Haggerty, if you can.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shadura. Mago Haggerty, if you could please put your name on the record. Provide your affiliation, residency, and begin your public testimony.
Yes, thank you. My name is Mako Haggerty. I'm a resident of Homer. I own and sometimes operate Mako's Water Taxi. I've spent quite a bit of time on the bay, and I'm believe very aware of its the amount of use that area gets from all sorts of user groups. I oppose House Bill 52. Kachemak Bay State Park is Alaska's first state park and a jewel in the state park system. And Tutka Bay Lagoon is a jewel in Kachemak Bay State Park. And the carving it up for special interests is a dangerous precedent for this park and all state parks. It also does a disservice to the legacy of the Clentillion, the original sponsor of the park, and Gail Phillips, past president or Speaker of the House, who worked so hard to protect and expand this park. The park is a growing economic engine. As other resources diminish, the park's continuing growth contributes more and more to the local economy. And so we want to support Alaska's critical visitor industry. So it makes no sense to reduce the size of this key economic contributor, that being Kachemak Bay State Park. It benefits so many, and we're House Bill 52 benefits so few. The other thing that bothers me is the zero fiscal note. I believe that is false. House Bill 52 will cost the state money, and we shouldn't pass this bill without knowing what those costs will be. And as I see it, House Bill 52 is a social program for special interests. So I think this needs to also, because of the latest change in House Bill 52, we've had 4 days to examine it, and I don't think that allows it to go through the proper public vetting process. And so thank you for your time. Thanks, everybody, for considering this. And please vote no on House Bill 52.
Thank you, Mr. Haggerty. Casey Adderhold, if you could please put your name on the record, provide your affiliation, residency, and begin your public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Casey Adderhold. I was born, raised, and I am a resident of Homer, Alaska. Today, I am representing myself and speaking in opposition to House Bill 52. This is a park issue, and I would advise that it be settled as such. It doesn't make sense to cut out an oversized chunk of the park, either temporarily or permanently, just because the hatchery isn't in compliance with the new management plan. Kachemak Bay State Park is a unique and important environment, and we don't want to get this wrong. I think it is worth taking the time to explore our options that do not resort to removal of this land from park management. House Bill 52 is too rash and sets a bad precedent for all of our parks. Park management plans must be able to be developed without fear that conflicts with narrow interests may end up in a loss of park land that is meant for the good of the public. The hatchery has been given 10 years of continued operations in which a solution could be sought out. The bay, the creatures that live there, including myself, the future of fisheries within it, these are all worth taking the time and energy to get it right while keeping the park intact for the highest and best use of the land. I respectfully encourage Representative Vance to withdraw House Bill 52. Thank you for your time and consideration of this testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Dutterhold. Aaron Peterson, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, residency, and begin your public testimony.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. This is Aaron Peterson. I'm from Homer, and I speak for myself. I am strongly opposed to HB 52, mainly because I think it's a legal issue. It sets a precedent for removing land from the park. And if this were to happen, if this happened, this would just help a few people. And do that does not make sense, because this is going to happen all over the state if this is granted. And we get no benefit from Cottonwood Eastland from this bill. Being a trade is kind of ridiculous. And I think probably this is just kind of a bill for special interest. So I'm strongly opposed. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mark Thomas, if you could please put your name on the record, your affiliation and residency, and provide your public testimony.
Yeah, my name is Mark Thomas. I'm a resident of Anchor Point. Thank you for posting this, and I weigh in on support of HB 52. Have quite a bit of history there at Tuckta Bay Lagoon, actually, my first experience there was in the late 80s. I drifted in a sport fishing boat and caught pink salmon. First fish in Alaska was pink salmon. Yay, pink salmon! Okay. Anyway, the broodstock situation there at the hatchery, that because they had to import broodstock for the Lower Cook Inlet Lakes spawning program. It had to be moved there because there was no other options for Cook Inlet aquaculture to do that. And I am speaking for myself. I got a couple of questions too, and I'd like you legislators to think about this too. It seems to me that people are saying that we're going to lose access to the lagoon if it goes to 52. I don't see that. People are still going to be able to drift in and catch pinks and the sockeye, the few sockeye that are floating around in there. That's not going away from what I understand. The trail system is still there. You can still go from Jackloft to Tuckta Bay Lagoon. That's still there. So is that going to go away? I don't think so, unless I'm wrong. So if the trail systems are still open for people to come over, if somebody can still drift in and shoot a black bear on the beach in there in the spring hunts, then what's the deal if DNR manages it or if the parks manage it? That's all I got to say. Please support it.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. David Seaman, if you could please put your name on the record, affiliation, residency, and provide your public testimony.
This is Dave Seaman. Do you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Yeah, I'm Dave Seaman. I live in Little Tuckta Bay near Big Tuckta Bay, about 9-10 miles from the hatchery. I oppose HB 52. I have quite some history with the hatchery myself. All their supplies up there on my mail run, all their mail, all their personnel back and forth, especially in the days when it was owned by Fish and Game. And it seems like they made the right decision to get out of the Fred division when they did, eh?
as well as pink salmon controversy. I would rate the success of the hatchery as Fish and Game probably would, with whether they're providing fish for the common property fishery, and not just for themselves, which they haven't really done since CIAA has taken it over. So that's, you know, I would say that it's been a success, and they've only, you know, they have their own little fiefdom up there with their own private industry, you know, sell their own fish to whoever they want. And the commercial fishermen in the area, whom, you know, I ran a tender, I bought fish out of Tutka, I bought fish all over the bay. And suddenly they went away out of Tutka, and they stayed away, and they're still away. So, you know, I don't know why the other fishermen aren't, you know, excited about this. They're 2%. It's taken out of their pay, and they're not getting any benefit. You know, there's a lot been said about what happens with pink salmon hit out and, you know, competing with other species and the same species in this bay. Anyway, I'm not into giving away parkland to a private interest group. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Seaman. Seeing that we've exhausted the queue of folks online, I just want to ask if there was anybody else in the room that wanted to provide public testimony. Seeing or hearing none, Talia, can you confirm that there's no one else online? Thank you. With that, we'll close public hearing on House Bill 52. Thank you for all of the folks that called in to provide their public testimony. As I've said numerous times throughout the testimony, you can still provide written comment in regards to the bill as long as it's still in committee. I'm going to allow Mr. Raybung and the bill sponsor to address any of the concerns and questions that were brought up during our public testimony, but I'd first like to apologize to Representative Vance. It's my duty to keep control of the meeting, and I allowed some remarks that were defaming to your character, and I apologize for that. We don't ask for the issues that we deal with in our communities, but we make a valiant effort to try to solve them, and I applaud you for that effort. So with that, we had a question from Representative Fields for Mr. Raybung. Mr. Raybung, do you need that question restated?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the question was about the sockeye program.
Representative Fields.
Yes, through the chair, there was some discussion about the China Poot dipnet fishery, and my question was, I think some people have said for about 9 years CIAA was not operating as part of that, supporting that China Poot dipnet fishery. So for that time, how did that fishery keep operating? What was done as an alternative to using this particular hatchery?
Okay. Thank you, Representative Fields, through the chair. So that's not quite accurate. The hatchery stopped producing pinks for a period of time because the price of pinks was so low. They did continue to use the hatchery for the sockeye program, and China Poot was continued to be stocked. But my understanding is they were running out of ways to fund it. So and the price of pinks came back, and the demand for pinks is still through the roof. So there's tremendous demand for pinks. And just an aside, every hatchery program that we have in the state, that regardless of what their mix of species is, they all have pinks and or chums as their cost recovery fish. That's the bread and butter fish of these programs. So the sockeye program, the Lower Cook Inlet Lakes sockeye program, which includes Hazel Leisure and Kirshner on the west side of Cook Inlet, are all produced right now by broodstock that are released at Tutka Bay Lagoon Hatchery. So the eggs are collected at Tutka Bay Lagoon Hatchery. It's true that Trail Lakes Hatchery is where they're incubated and reared to the fry stage, or the smolt stage in the case of Tutka. And then they were taken off-site and released at those Lower Cook Inlet Lakes projects. But the broodstock is at Tutka, and it's kind of complex. I'll try to make it as clear as I can. Previously, the broodstock for the Lower Cook Inlet Lakes projects came from Testamina Lake, So the eggs were collected from wild stock that matured in the lake every year, and when they reach sexual maturity and were able to spawn, that's when they swim up into the stream to try to spawn, and that's when the broodstock is collected and the eggs collected and flown to the Trail Lakes hatchery for incubation, rearing, and then subsequent outplanting at the release sites. The federal government determined that commercial activity in Tuscaloosa Lake, Tuscaloosa Lake, because it's a wilderness area, was incompatible. So we had to find another location. So for a period of time, we took eggs from Hidden Lake in Kenai, part of the Kenai River system. They were not a good fit for the Lower Cook Inlet Lakes project because those are fish that swim 100 miles upstream and go into a lake to rear and spawn. So they weren't well adapted to the life history of the Lower Cook Inlet Lakes project. So we did some more looking, and we found the English Bay Lake stock, which is the nearest significant stock of sockeye and is the appropriate stock for all the Lower Cook Inlet Lakes stocking programs, and it's been identified in the Cook Inlet Comprehensive Salmon Plan as the appropriate stock. So to shift to that, Cook Inlet Aquaculture, and with Fish and Game's assistance, went into English Bay Lakes with the assistance of the community of Namwalek, because it's their land, and collected eggs for, I believe, 3 or 4 years. Those eggs were incubated at Trail Lakes Hatchery, and the fry were released at the Lower Cook Inlet Lakes projects and at Tuckta Bay Lagoon Hatchery, where they were they imprint there, so they would return there. Once the fish start returning to Tuckta Bay Lagoon Hatchery, then we didn't need to go into English Bay Lakes anymore, and which was timely because the community there was done with us being on their land. And so now all the broodstock returns to Tuckta Bay Lagoon Hatchery, and the eggs are collected there. They're flown to Trail Lakes, incubated to the juvenile stage, and then taken from Trail Lakes out to be outplanted. That's the cycle. Now, Trail Lakes doesn't have any salmon that return to it. It's what we call a central incubation facility. So all eggs have to be transported into Trail Lakes Hatchery, and all the juveniles have to be transported out for release somewhere else. It's not connected to a water system that we use. And the reason Trail Lakes is used for sockeye is because it's on well water. It's on virus-free water. Tuckta Bay does not have virus-free water. So all we can do there is collect the eggs and release the fish. But we can't incubate the eggs and rear them there. That would violate our sockeye salmon policy. I know I covered a lot of ground there, and it's a kind of a tangled web, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, that's actually the kind of the information I was looking for, is how it's been run over the years. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields and Mr. Raybung. Maybe a flow chart might help with kind of the gamut of words there. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. My questions are, I'm going to direct them at Representative Vance because they're from her briefing paper, but one of my questions may default to Mr. Raybung. I'm going to, through Mr. Chairman, I am trying to avoid fish politics. I'm looking to completely understand the legal land disposal issues that bring us to the situation. Your briefing paper that you provided to all of us included 4 court precedences. The first one, 2 of them were vague enough where there were so many pieces of litigation that I couldn't quite tell what state lands were litigated. So the first one that you cite is Northern Alaska Center versus State DNR that establishes the functionally irrevocable test. Do you know what DNR land that case was about? Was it in a state park or, because the second one is in a state recreation area, the Nancy Lake State Recreation Area. But do you know where that one was?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, for the record, this is Representative Sarah Vance of House District 31. We, because that is a technical legal question, we have Chris Orman from the Department of Law on record who provided that documentation. That is a white paper directly from DNR, and he can better answer that question.
Okay.
So, Mr. Orman, if you're on the line, please address Representative Hannon's line of question.
sorry there. Representative Hannon, through the chair, I have a hard time with the mute button. So I need to go back and look at the North Alaska Environmental Center case. I was just pulling it up as you asked that question to make sure as far as the land. My recollection is that other than the SOP incorporated case, that the other cases are dealing with public domain lands, so general state lands, and that the SOP case really is the one that is addressing and dealing with TARC land, or legislatively, I should even be more specific than that, legislatively withdrawn land.
Okay, that helps. Thank you.
Follow.
Because the other ones, I was able to find the Nunavut one, and my last question on that was going to be about the SEAC one, but if they're general state undesignated lands, that helps. Then there's one more follow-up that may go to that same white paper references in point one on the second page that the plain languages of ADF&G's 2014 agreement with Cook Inlet Aquaculture, that's the opening line. The last line in that paragraph is the agreement states the parties would work towards transferring the Tutka Bay Lagoon Hatchery facilities to Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association. I had a meeting with Fish and Game, Mr. Raybon, yesterday, and had a different read on that. So I'm looking to find out your DNR read is that the lease leads to a transfer of the facilities to Cook Inlet Aquaculture. I believe in my conversation with Fish and Game, the assertion is this remains Fish and Game land, that the hatchery is Fish and Game, and that Cook Inlet Aquaculture is simply a contractor that could be terminated on a 90-day notice. So, to the lawyer, which one is more accurate?
Thank you, Representative Hannon, through the chair. So, first I want to clarify something. The SEAC case that was mentioned in the last question.
Yes.
I probably jumped the gun a little bit. I just want to clarify. So the SEAC case was unique because it was talking about general state lands, public domain lands, and about an issue involving the mental health trust and trust lands. So it's really kind of a complicated issue of conveyance and lack of public notice and those issues. So in general, that one still is probably general state lands, but there's a lot of nuance to the SEAC case, which is why I probably, in helping review that white paper, gave it short shrift. So apologies in that regard for not being thorough on my last answer. Now to answer the question about the agreement, I don't necessarily disagree with Fish and Game's point there. I will say two things. As far as pursuant to the language in the 2014 agreement, there's two things that I'm going to point out as far as I think things that have been stated that are are concern about that agreement. So first, the idea that legislatively withdrawn lands could ever be at any point potentially conveyed to an entity like CIA is a problem. The fact that the agreement is referred to potentially as a lease or suggests a lease and a lease concept is a problem when we're talking about legislatively withdrawn lands. I think even when you're talking about the idea that given the legislature set these lands aside for the department to manage the lands, and only to be the one managing these lands, the idea that Fish and Game somehow holds a lease or interest to the lands or holds the land is problematic when we start talking about disposal, when we start talking about the functionally irrevocable test. So I think as far as in that white paper and talking about that agreement, when you start looking at the agreement and as I think, you know, you've kind of characterized it, and I think it's natural, others have characterized it in the public as a lease, that I think when you start even realizing and thinking about the idea that there's a potential lease of legislatively withdrawn land, that's then the trigger as far as the functional revocable test. That's the problem, and that's the disposal. Now, there's a lot of other facts out there about disposal and the functional revocable test that I don't know are necessary to go into, but I hope in kind of pointing that out, I clarified a little bit the disposal and as far as the white paper and trying to be general and talk about disposal and not necessarily, pointing out every single fact that may exist here in a kind of a functional or irrevocable analysis that could be confusing.
Thank you, Mr. Orman. Representative Hannon, follow-up.
One more follow-up. So I'm going to ask you in the inverse because not all of us policymakers speak legalese. If that was not a lease to an entity, but if ADF&G were operating the aquaculture location, the hatchery, as it did in its original state, would that would then not be an irrevocable land because it remains in state hands?
So if that were to happen, so backing up, if only ADF&G was operating the hatchery and it was the state operation of the hatchery, I think that there's still a problem potentially with the ILMA, and there's also then the definition of scenic park. Now, admittedly, and this is where, you know, we have a lot of history, there's a lot of documents, there's a lot of different viewpoints here, but I think the answer to that question becomes complicated, and it's not as simple as saying, well, then we don't. Maybe the best way to put this, and I'll try not to sound like a lawyer when I say this, I think the best answer would be, well, we may not then directly have the disposal problem we have, which is the investment, the interest there, the functional irrevocable problem. I think then there's still going to be other legal problems that would have to be addressed and figured out. So I think that's maybe the best way I can answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Orman. Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Raybung, you look like you're chomping at the bit there. Did you need to clarify anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have the contract in front of me. We call it a professional services agreement between Alaska Department of Fish and Game and our contractor, Cook Inlet Aquaculture. And it says, one sentence, which was just referenced. It says, during this term, the parties agree to explore the possibility of the transfer of ownership of the hatchery to CIAA. We did that, and we determined that it wasn't legal. So that's all that is in there. There was members of the public that were pushing us to transfer ownership of the state hatcheries to the contractors all across the state. We have 12 hatcheries that are contracted operators. So we investigated it, and it's not legal. Another portion of the contract states, Article 7, Interagency Land Management Assignment, ILMA. ADF&G holds an ILMA from the Department of Natural Resources, a copy of which is attached and made part of this contract. There is no expiration date. The contractor shall be responsible for complying with the terms and conditions of the ILMA and any additional amendments. Yes. The ILMA authorizes land use for the Tutka Bay Lagoon Hatchery, and the ILMA is not transferable from the state to CIAA. The state of Alaska retains primary responsibility for adherence to the condition of the ILMA. So I think that's important to get on the record. This is a state hatchery on state land, regardless of whether the land is general DNR state land or state parks land. That doesn't change. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that the only thing changing since 1976 when the hatchery was constructed where it's at is the paperwork regarding the land status. There's nothing new going to be built or developed. I mean, it's just basically being grandfathered and continued operation as it has been since the state invested into it and built it in 1976 using state bond money. I wouldn't mind if I had an opportunity to address just a couple topics that were raised in public testimony. One thing was mentioning the unconstitutionality. I wanted to point out that aquaculture is included in our Constitution in Article 8, Section 15. Also, our state statute, 1605.092, directs us to do these things. So we're doing what the state law requires us to do. Let's see. Another topic was changing the hatchery into something, some other use. Well, my understanding is that it's not the hatchery that's at issue. It's the disposal of land that's at issue. So regardless of what the facility is, whether it's a hatchery or a wilderness center or a Girl Scout camp or a shooting range, the land issue is the same. And so I thought that was something I should point out. Another person mentioned Mr. Clem Tillian, who was kind of the founder of the park. Well, interestingly, Mr. Clem Tillian is also the one who got the hatchery built. and has spoken prior to his passing in support of the hatchery continuing. I just wanted to get those on the record. Thank you for indulging me.
Thank you, Mr. Raybon. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, this is Representative Sarah Vance. I just wanted to mention that the CIA contract is on basis for members of the committee and for the public to view in what was just previously discussed.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Any other committee member questions? Clarifications? Nothing. Okay. Never did I think I'd be working on CIA contracts. Representative Vance, before we close out, I'd like to give you the floor to provide any comments on anything in regards to HB 52.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say thank you to the public who called and testified, and I respect the positions of everyone who supports and opposes this bill. This is part of the public process that we all respect and love here, and especially thank DNR and Fish and Game for working on this piece of legislation with me so closely.
Thank you very much, Representative Vance. I'd like to also extend my gratitude for the members of the public who exercise their duty to weigh in on the discussions that the legislature has in regards to lawmaking, and show my appreciation for that. So just a reminder to the committee that the amendment deadline for House Bill 52 and 287 are due to the office by 1 p.m. Sunday. Grace Irving will be waiting patiently Saturday and Sunday for any amendments that do come in. We'll be picking both of these bills back up on Monday to address any of those amendments and whatever action the committee might want to take in regards to the bills. Also, just for your calendaring, we'll be picking up House Bill 209, which is Emergency Firefighters, by Representative Kronk, and that'll happen on Wednesday, barring any delays with House Bill 52 and 287. Going later into the week, Friday, February 18th, meeting is canceled, along with the following Monday, February 21st, meeting will be canceled. So look forward to meeting with you all again on Monday, and the meeting is now adjourned at 3:08 p.m. Thank you very much, everyone.